final closing, final reads. And I'd like to welcome tonight Justin, who has very graciously zoomed his way up from Richmond tonight in the hazards of the weather. And we really appreciate him doing this. We were looking forward to the live version, but we'll take the Zoom version, and really looking forward to his story. And Justin's been up to see us before, and he's an old friend of our group, and we're just grateful to have him here tonight. So everybody, welcome Justin.
Yay!
Thank you. My name is Justin Slocum, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's great to be here. I think this is the easiest way to give a talk, although I love to see you guys in person. And like I was sharing earlier, the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting has always been one of the fundamental things that's helped me stay sober, because, you know, I think most of us can come into a meeting for an hour and not take a drink. But, you know, for me, it was the crucial time after many of you guys, Sam, Billy, Lynn, all you guys have been up to my old home group, to Jaywalkers, and I've heard you all talk. And I remember the first time I came out to Madison with my sponsor, Alex, and to watch him give a talk. And that was the beginning of my most recent journey back into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not my first go around. It's my third. Well, I never really left the second time. I just took a sabbatical for about a month. And you know, it's amazing what it takes for a guy like me to finally surrender everything. You know, I think that was part of the problem. And I guess the first part of my talk is going to be about what led me to my first surrender. And, you know, I guess hopefully the second half is going to be about what your reading talks about, which was, you know, how I stay sober and continue to seek out a relationship with God that helps me stay restored to sanity against the next drink. Because for me, that you know, I think that, you know, the daily stuff that we do in here, it can evaporate in a matter of hours. If I'm not careful, I can drift. And I guess that's part of my story, is I the first time I was 7.5 years sober, and I drifted, you know, one by one. I kind of relinquished, you know, one thing after another that was helping me stay sober. Before you know it, I wasn't sponsoring anybody. I wasn't calling my sponsor regularly. And when I wasn't really giving them the full scoop on what's going on with me. And I wasn't being active in my home group, and I wasn't praying regularly. So I, you know, there was no defense against the next drink, so it wasn't surprising. But I will start. My sobriety is February 7th of 2008. Like I said, that's my third one. And hopefully, God willing, it's my final sobriety date. I don't think I need to do any more research. I know I have plenty of good drinking left in me. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I never disliked any drink that came my way. I mean, that's one thing, you know, even when it didn't taste so great, I knew what it was going to do for me. And I pursued that, you know, ever since day one. I was born up in Connecticut, and my parents, you know, they were Woodstock hippies, I guess. My dad was kind of this, I don't know, he was big into motorcycles, and he and my mother split up when I was three, and then my mom remarried, and I had a stepfather who had a pretty strong influence on my life, helped me get introduced into sports, you know, at a young age. And I started playing hockey and a lot of sports. I was always active, riding my bicycle all over the place back when, you know, kids would just run all over town on bikes, and we just had a blast. Up until I was a teenager, I thought I was pretty comfortable in my own skin, I guess. You know, I was a little hyperactive, maybe. You know, maybe I had a little rambunctiousness, I guess. But other than that, you know, I didn't really feel what you hear people talk about in the rooms of out of place or didn't fit in and all these other, you know, phrases that you hear people talk about. You know, I always wanted to fit in. And maybe I looked at myself as maybe a the kind of guy that could, you know, adapt and fit in. I did change schools a lot, so I had to make quick friends. And you know, when I maybe got used to the awkward feeling of having to go in and be the new kid in the classroom. I went to 3 different elementary schools, 2 different middle schools, and 2 different high schools. And had great friends in all of them, you know, but when I got to be 13, I had already, you know, taken a Schaefer beer out of my grandfather's refrigerator and snuck it out into the woods and drank it. And I didn't know what the big deal was. And I guess, you know, that beer alone explained why that six pack would stay in there for weeks. And I, you know, and it wouldn't be touched. But that's what was always in his refrigerator. And my grandparents also had a liquor cabinet, which had all kinds of interesting bottles, you know, bottles with green liquid, tall, skinny bottles, you know, that had really fancy labels. And, you know, my grandmother would always pour some scotch on the rocks and sit by the bay window and watch the birds and the neighbors walk by. And I didn't think anything of it. That was just a regular routine. She wasn't an alcoholic in my eyes, but, and, you know, as far as I know, none of my immediate family is an alcoholic, but, I broke the mold for that one. So I definitely think I paved the way for alcoholism. My grandfather on my father's side died of cirrhosis of the liver. My dad says that he was a bad, bad drinker. He died when my father was 14. So maybe it skipped a generation and I got my grandfather's awesome drinking ability. But 13 years old, I, you know, started coming home. My mother was working full time, divorced, and she was going to school in Manhattan at nighttime. So I was what you would call a latchkey kid, where I would come home and, you know, I had a key to the house, and we lived in a condominium, and I would come home and just, you know, kind of turn on the TV and, you know, make a snack or something and just kind of hang out and wait for her to get back from school at night, which was usually around 8 or 9 o'clock. That was usually about 3 or 4 nights a week. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly, but I had a lot of free time and I had a lot of friends down the street, and I found them and I hung out with them. And one of them had an older brother who was always getting into trouble, and it looked adventurous. You know, he was always getting picked up by the police and chased by the police, and had this fast motorcycle. He would zip up and down the street, and, you know, and I got introduced to dry goods, you know, and they were easily accessible. We were 30 minutes outside of New York City, so that stuff was easier to get than a case of beer. But we were very ingenuitive. I always found ways to get beer, liquor. I wasn't really afraid to sit out in front of the grocery store and ask several strangers to, you know, go in and buy a case of beer and hand them a $10 bill and get a case of Meisterbrau or whatever. And usually it was the cheapest. We were going for volume. But, you know, like I said, I experimented with one beer one time, didn't do anything. Tasted, what was it, creme de menthe. That was interesting, but, you know, nothing happened. Smoked a little bit of reefer. Nothing happened, you know. Then I tried some other dry goods and a little bit of something happened. But then I can remember the first time. Well, it's kind of vague because I was thinking about it the other day. If my first real drunk was down at the river when we got a case of beer and snuck it back into the woods, or and drank and then got drunk at the river, or at Karina Robinson's house, where it was in between 7th and 8th grade, where her parents were away and they had a liquor cabinet. And what happened was, is my buddies, Peter and Paul and myself, we went in there. Like I said, it was my first year back at this new school. I only knew a couple of people, close friends from way back, you know, when I was in elementary school, I guess, in kindergarten. I had a couple of friends that I, you know, reconnected with. Because we had moved out of town for 6 or 7 years while my mother was married to my stepfather. And then we moved back into my town, the neighboring town where I was born, and I went back to middle school there. So I didn't know all the kids. I didn't fit in quite, you know, like there was jocks, there was popular kids, there were preppy kids, you know, and then there was, you know, I guess we were like the future burnouts, maybe, I don't know, but we, you know, we all kind of came from the same place, but, you know, I still didn't feel quite, you know, sure where I fit in when I stepped into Karina Robinson's party. And this is the only vivid memory I have of getting, well, this is my first blackout, I'll tell you that. That I was maybe 13 going on 14, and Karina Robinson's house, we had liquor cabinet, asked her if we could drink some of the vodka. And she said, just don't take all of it. I don't want my parents to find out when they come back. We won't, we won't. We poured, we didn't know anything about mixology. We just poured four fingers of vodka and two fingers of, I think all we had was Diet Coke. And, you know, it looked good, you know, and it was, of course, lukewarm. And, you know, one sip, and it was the most vile combination I'd ever tasted. But I'm not a quitter. That's how I made it to AA. I you know, committed to, I'm going to get this over with quick. So I chugged it. And boy, I'll tell you, when people talk about that warm sensation that goes down your belly, and, you know, it was almost instantaneous. Within 30 seconds, I didn't care if I fit in with those kids, where I fit in with those kids, whether they liked me or not. I went from being this nervous, insecure, you know, 13-year-old kid who didn't know where he belonged and only had a couple of friends around and was, you know, really shy, to being cool, calm, and collective within maybe 45 seconds. I mean, all of a sudden I'm like, you know, we're good. Let's do another. And I maybe two more of those four finger vodka drinks, and I don't remember anything. And it was kind of like I was coming in and coming to and going back out again. And it was like a flash frame, you know, I was passed out on the deck, woke up, started making out with some girl next to me, we passed out, woke up next to a speaker that was blasted, you know, on 10 decibels, you know, all the way up to 100 decibels. And I'm sitting there passed out next to it. Next time I woke up, I was in different clothes. And I don't know how they got there, but I found out later that I had thrown up, and the host, Karina, actually had to get her brother's sweats and change my clothes, and she washed my clothes for me. And it was kind of embarrassing because I, you know, it's not the way I wanted things to go. You know, it was a little shocking and disturbing to find out, but I was still drunk when I woke up and discovered I had different clothes on. And the next day I woke up and my head was pounding, my eyes were bleeding, I felt sick to my stomach, I felt nauseous, I couldn't stand the smell of any kind of alcohol whatsoever. I don't know. And I was very shaky. I do remember being really shaky when I woke up and very sick feeling. And, you know, at that time, that morning, it was a really misty, cold morning in the spring, early spring. And I said, I'm not going to drink anymore. I think it was maybe the next day or maybe a couple of days later, I'm just not going to drink like that anymore, you know? And then it was, well, I'm just going to maybe have a beer when, you know, when the smell of alcohol doesn't make me sick anymore. And that was maybe 5 or 6 weeks later, I started drinking beers again. And then in the back of my mind, I was just going to learn how to control and enjoy it, you know, and drink like a gentleman, you know, like the seniors in high school. Okay. Next phase was hanging out with the older kids. That's what I did best. Always hung out with people who had access to go get booze at the store. And most of those people were, you know, either, this was before the drinking age turned 21, and the seniors were still able to get beer because they were grandfathered in. And I was a freshman or a sophomore, I guess. And no, I was a freshman in ninth grade. And by then I was drinking at every possible chance that I could get. My mother had come down with cancer, and I didn't know how to handle with that. She had breast cancer, and she had to go through chemotherapy and radiation. She lost all her hair. I was scared that I was going to lose my mom. My dad was down in Lynchburg, Virginia, and I didn't have a close relationship with him. I only saw him once a year around Christmas and, you know, for maybe 4 weeks in the summertime, I'd come down to Lynchburg. but there was summers where I only had 2 weeks with them. And, you know, it was just, we didn't have, it was hard, you know, it was whatever, 8 hours away. And, you know, so anyways, long story short, you know, I didn't know how to handle it emotionally. So I just kind of escaped with my friends and escaped with older kids too. She did not get emotional about it. She just kind of went through her, you know, process of, you know, her surgeries and her chemo and radiation. And she was a trooper. I was probably not a good son at that time because I was, like I said, escaping and running. So what that looked like was I would caddy at a golf course on the weekends and I would make a little money. And then I would hang out with the older guys that were caddying. There were some folks that were in their 20s, into their 30s, 40s, and they were pretty good drunks. I mean, they would show up at, you know, 6:30 in the morning, you know, in the caddy shack, waiting in the cart garage with all the golf carts, passing around a pint of pop-off vodka. And that's when I got an affinity for pop-off vodka because when I was 15, I guess, when I started caddying, I'd walk out of there with like $80 at 1 o'clock in the afternoon for carrying two bags around 18 holes. And, you know, that's a good chunk of change for a 15-year-old. And, you know, I'm going to go hang out with these guys in the park because they're all going to get a pint of pop off and an oil can of Foster's lager. So that's what I wanted in a pack of Marlboros. So I'd hang out with the folks in the park and I'd drink that pop off vodka and chase it back with Foster's lager. And I managed to run into this guy called Zane. And we called him Insane Zane because he was living in but it was a halfway house for the mentally ill and the disturbed. And he was on Thorazine. And I was fascinated with that because I wanted some. And so I begged Zane to bring in some Thorazine to the park next week. And sure enough, he brought me one or two of them and I took one and I couldn't even, I 15, 20 minutes later, I was face down in the grass and I couldn't even get up. I was licking the grass blades. For 2 hours, I could not move. I was paralyzed. Finally got up and called my grandmother and told her I was sick and, you know, if she could come pick me up. So I was doing anything I could, you know, to escape and, you know, whether it be, you know, drinking with older folks or, you know, staying out all night. Which I did frequently. I'd go out to the seniors where they had keg parties in the woods and I would try to drink straight from the tap as much as they did. And, you know, of course my tolerance level wasn't near what theirs was because they had built up their drinking capacity. And, you know, and I was still, you know, a rookie drinker as far as that concerned. But I, like I said, I'm not a quitter. So by the time I got to be in my sophomore year, I think I was a pretty well-rounded drinker. I kind of, you know, knew how far I could take it as far as, you know, and I wasn't getting sick and I would just, you know, either pass out or black out. And that was the norm for me. I didn't really become a daily drinker until later on into my sophomore year in high school in 10th grade. I started to become a daily drinker. And I used every substance that I could get my hands on. And in school, it was like a flea market for drugs. And drugs are a part of my story because, I mean, you know, they were easy to, I mean, it was just, I mean, it was around and I did, you know, anything that would get me out of myself, you know, was what I was going to grab onto. And, yeah, I mean, I you know, experimented with everything, you know, was a daily, you know, smoker and drinker. And, you know, by the time I got into my junior year, I had this girlfriend who was 19. She'd already graduated from high school and she was a deadhead. And we had gone to a few shows and then we came up with this great idea that, you know, now's the time to go on spring tour. And of course, spring tour started in like early March. Down in like, I want to say Kentucky, Louisville, Greensboro, and then on up the East Coast up to, I think, Worcester, Massachusetts, and on up into upstate New York, and then out west to Wisconsin and California. We were going to follow the tour all the way through the summer and land in California and then just kind of like figure it out from there. And that's what we had planned. So I showed up in my high school with a sleeping bag, a tent, some clothes, And I went to my guidance counselor. She asked, I was going to say goodbye to all my friends because, you know, here we are. We got some bus tickets. We're going to go down to Greensboro and then just, you know, hitch rides with people and, you know, make money however we could. And you know, we were pretty ingenuitive that way. So I took off and my guidance counselor said she was fascinated. She said, well, good luck. And, you know, my mother got a letter 3 weeks later. She didn't know where I'd gone because I didn't really want to, you know, have the resistance of what, you know, her, she wouldn't have agreed to that, you know, me dropping out of 11th grade and to go follow a rock band or, you know, anything like that. So I just went and she got a letter from the school and she still has it to this day. And she didn't really show it to me until I was probably 5 years sober. And she's like, I never showed you this, but the school sent me this letter and they said, we're really concerned about Justin. We haven't seen him in 3 weeks. There were rumors that he'd gone off to follow the Grateful Dead. We just wanted to, you know, see if he was planning on coming back this year or what's going on. And, so she didn't know where I was for the next 3 or 4 months and, you know, ended up, you know, living in a tent in a state park for a month and a half, hiding from the police because our, whatever connection got busted and we freaked out and left and hid out in the state park and things weren't going so great in the tent after about a month or so. And, you know, we tried to save up enough money to get this old Datsun B210 beat up, you know, car for $600. We were going to try and drive that out to the West Coast and we could never quite save up that $600. We'd get to $400 and spend it all on the weekend and party. And we'd get to $500 and spend it all. And, you know, we just hung out in that park where all the partiers hung out. And so anyway, she found me one day, 3 or 4 months later, and she came to that park because I guess she got wind from one of my friends where I was living. And it was about an hour and a half away from where I grew up. And she drove out there and I was high on LSD that day. And she tried to convince me to come to my senses and she didn't know what was going on, but I was paying more attention to the squirrels and the birds and everything than to what she was saying. But 5 hours later, we had had a conversation and I have no clue what it was about, but she convinced me to call my dad and I did. And my friends are sitting there in the car, anxious to go. Everybody's all, you know, blitzed out of their mind. They want to go into the city to go see some concert. And I'm sitting there talking to my dad, confused, emotional, don't know what to say. Just want to run away, you know? He says, well, why don't you come down and stay with me? And I said, I'll think about it. And my mother begged me to come back home. And I said, I'll think about it. And, you know, maybe a week or so, 2 weeks later, I decided, all right, I'm going to give it a shot and went back home. And, you know, 36 hours later, she handed me a bus ticket and said, look, if you can't live by my rules, you know, you're going to go down and live with your dad because you can't live here. This is because I was doing the same thing I was doing before I left for on tour was I was staying out all night. Would come home, you know, the next day, usually intoxicated. I was worrying her to death. You know, I had all these shady character old friends that were, you know, 24 years old and I'm, you know, a 16 year old you know, she knew what was going on, but she didn't know how to, you know, I mean, she couldn't control it. I couldn't control it. Nobody could control it. You asked me why I was doing what I was doing. I had no clue. I just want to have a good time. You know, that's what it was for me. No consequences and you know, laughing at not remembering things and, you know, that from the night before and, you know, maybe a few embarrassing moments here and there. But, you know, that's just the cost of doing business when you're, you know, trying to have fun. And that's kind of the way my brain took it. And I didn't think there was a problem, but it seemed like everybody else was having a problem with me, my drinking, I should say, not me, but my drinking. But I had that same justification. I'm not harming anyone, you know, and that wasn't the truth. But in my brain, you know, I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. You know, my brain told me I was okay and nothing. I'm not doing anything wrong to hurt anybody. Well, it couldn't be any more of the contrary because, you know, my family, you know, was suffering just as much as anybody. And I was too numb to see it or even believe it, you know. So onward I go. And I finally ended up going down to my dad's with that bus ticket. And he coerced me, you know, he lied. Well, he didn't lie to me. He was deceptive. He says, I got this car, this Volkswagen Bug down here. I was going to fix it up and well, if you want to fix it up, you can have it. And I thought, wow, he's giving me a car. What an awesome dad, you know, what a great guy, you know. And I get down to, you know, Lynchburg, and here I am with this ponytail and this long hair. And I got my two stepsisters just looking at me with their jaw dropped, because last time they saw me, I had this, you know, nice little clean cut haircut and I was playing baseball. And here I am wearing a tie dye, smelling like patchouli, and coming in with like this ponytail, and, you know, and they're trying to figure out, you know, what happened, you know, three years later, I've transformed. I have a stepsister who was my age, and she had some pretty friends that came over one day, and one of them made a comment and said, you know, I like guys with short hair. And I said, well, I volunteered to let her cut my hair right there and then, and I'll anything to get a date, you know. And I was like, flying under the radar. I got out there and my dad showed me this Volkswagen Bug in the lot where the repair shop was, where his Volkswagen Bug was. And I was looking all over for it. And this was a really saddening moment, because I thought it was going to be a car that you just needed maybe, you know, an oil change and maybe a valve adjustment. And we couldn't find it. And he's like, oh, there it is. And it was over in the edge of the woods, you know, practically in the woods. And the thing had a motor in the front seat. Grass was growing up through the floorboards. It was all rusted out. And I looked in, you know, in the engine compartment in the back, it was nothing there. And it was in the front seat, you know, and it was just shot. It was like, I mean, he must've taken it from that, you know, salvage yard for like $150, but he says, it's yours. And so I spent the next year, you know, washing dishes, getting drunk with the college students down the street, because there was a college, Lynchburg College, just down the street from where we live. So I'd go wash dishes at this Chinese restaurant at night, leave there at 10:30, stop off at Angry House, which was this fraternity, and 16, 17 years old. And I would drink with them until, you know, 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, and then walk home drunk. My dad would be asleep on the couch and I just walk by him as fast as I could, and then ricochet off the walls in the hallway back to my bedroom, wake up and go to school. And, you know, and I did that, and that's how I got through my 11th grade, repeating my 11th grade year. And I actually got decent grades because I showed up every day. Decent grades for me was like C's and B's. So I finished putting together that car, and, you know, it didn't look like there was any more problems. You know, I looked clean cut, and, you know, I'd gotten fairly decent grades. I put this car together, you know, I didn't know anything about mechanics, and I got this Chilton's manual, and, you know, so I felt like I'd accomplished something. I wanted to go back up to Connecticut to reconnect with my friends and show them all the great stuff going on in my life, at, you know, and I was getting ready to turn 18. So I did. And, you know, my dad really didn't, he wanted me to stay down there with him, but, you know, of course, you know, I just wanted to do my own thing. And selfishly, I just kind of wanted to go back and hang out with my friends. And my mother had recovered. And I think, you know, the cancer was in remission. It did come back, but then she got another operation, and it's been in remission for over the last 30, 40 years, I guess. So she's in good shape and she's healthy. I talked to her this morning, and I have connections with my family and they can find me every day. My phone number hasn't changed. You know, I've had the same job for the last 17 years. It wasn't always the case. So when I went back up to Connecticut, I ended up getting my GED because I was too ashamed to go back to high school. And because I didn't want to go back with my lower classmates. So it was kind of an ego thing, I guess. And what happened after that was, I got interested in cooking and culinary arts because I'd worked at this restaurant, and I'd always worked construction in the summertime. And I wasn't aware of any kind of a school that would teach me anything about the construction industry other than, you know, what I'd already learned hanging drywall and framing and doing some odds and ends and doing a little bit of painting. I actually worked in a couple of paint crews. But I always worked in the kitchens in the wintertime to make a little extra money. So I told my mother I was interested in being a chef one day. And she said, well, great, we're going to go look at schools tomorrow. So we went up to Vermont and looked at this school. And I was fascinated with it. And I was all in. And my grandmother offered to pay part of the tuition. And that helped out. And I got this job working in the at this little bakery in the town up in Montpelier, Vermont. And And I managed to, you know, stay on the straight and narrow for 2 years. So I didn't think there was any problem anymore. I was set to get an internship at a 5-star hotel in San Francisco, which I'd always wanted to go out west. So now my dreams are coming true. And, you know, at 21 years old, getting ready to turn 21, I'm you know, I've got this associate's degree in restaurant management and culinary arts, and I'm going out to work at the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco and start this, you know, new life. And I didn't know anybody out in San Francisco, but lo and behold, I ran into one of my classmates who was a clerk at the hotel that I stayed in the first night that I came into town looking for an apartment. I found an apartment. I had some roommates, and, you know, nobody can afford to have their own place there because, you know, we had four and five bedroom flats, and we all, like, you know, usually had three or four roommates in each flat, which took up the whole floor of a 3 or 4 story building. And we lived above a bar in Donington Park, named after a English racetrack. And we all, you know, my new roommates and I all used to hang out and just drink pints down in the bar. I wasn't drinking heavily, and I was, you know, committed to working at the Ritz-Carlton. And what happened there was I ended up connecting with the same people I always connect with, you know, the same type of people that like to turn the volume up with their drinking and drink until the wee hours of the morning. You know, because once I take a drink, I can't stop, you know, and, you know, I might be able to only have 2 or 3 for a little period of time, but at some point it becomes uncontrollable again. And the craving, you know, once I start to continue drinking is uncontrollable. And my I wasn't aware. I thought I was just wanting to have more fun, you know, and I would wake up hungover and just make it into work, you know, hurting, you know, but like a trooper, I would soldier on. And I ran into this guy who was working in that kitchen, and he always brought some stuff to work that, you know, kept the motor going, and so to speak. And you know, I would go run back into the bathroom, you know, in between preparing food, I would run back to the bathroom and sniff some of this stuff, and I'd be wide awake for the next 24 hours. And I got addicted to that stuff. And, you know, so I had two things going for me, you know, drinking all the time, and then that. And so one thing led to another. And that was the beginning of the demise, I guess you could say. I'd gotten in with a crowd of folks, and I'd gotten arrested for distribution of LSD and a felony charge for that. And, you know, because I just like to turn the volume up and party wherever I go. And you know, consequences started happening in real time. And, you know, so there's that. And that led to me losing two good jobs. I was working as a private chef moonlighting, which gave me a free apartment, all expenses paid. And I only had to cook one meal a week, 5-course meal on Thursdays for the owner of the building, who was a real estate broker, you know, well-to-do real estate broker in the Presidio. And so I had this great little apartment in the Presidio, and I was working full-time at the Ritz-Carlton. And it was almost going into my second year at the Ritz-Carlton. And, you know, I had a party over at this house where I was working as a private chef, and the owner found out while he was away on vacation. The neighbors complained about people parking on the lawn, people parking in the middle of the street, and shady characters walking in and out of the building. And, you know, he was pretty ticked off about that. And, you know, he said, "We're going to part ways." And I lost that gig. And that was right after I had picked up that little, you know, distribution charge. And then, you know, not too long after, I was unable to wake up in time to go to the Ritz-Carlton to show up for work at 7 a.m. I was showing up late and multiple times, way past their policies. And so I was, you know, out of control, and I lost that job. And then, you know, I went through a succession of jobs. And then finally, I just gave up trying to work because it was just interrupting my path of destruction. And I just continued on that path of destruction. And for me, it was just what the book talks about, where, you know, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization started to really take a hold on my life. And I couldn't, you know, lower my standards quick enough. I was hanging around with people that I never thought I would, you know, I mean, they would have been the people like a year or two prior. I would have been like, oh my God, you know, if I ever hang out with those folks, I'm gonna get some help. And then, you know, lo and behold, you know, 2.5 years later, I'm coming to them for advice on how to hold it together, because I just can't keep it together anymore. And you know, it was so it was 2 years of homelessness, bouncing around, living wherever I could, you know. Because I knew that I was supposed to do my community service hours and show up to my probation officers, which I never did. So there was a warrant out for me. So I really couldn't, you know, settle down anywhere. So I just bounced around from, you know, place to place, and really got in bad shape. And, you know, the only thing that separated from drugs and alcohol was when the police found me about 2.5 years later. You know, I ended up having to go in and you know, served a little bit of time there. And then I went in and detoxed in jail. And a week and a half into that, I realized that nothing was going to stop me from, when I get out, to going back to where I was before, which was taking another drink and taking another drug, which I had no control over the obsession. It was on me 24/7 while I was in jail. And I knew there was a huge problem. And I looked at all the destruction in my life, like I didn't have anything left. And I hadn't talked to my family in a long time. My mother was in the Peace Corps in North Yemen at the time, and she was away for a year and a half, 2 years. So she wasn't really aware that I had gone that far downhill. And I had roommates that were calling distant family members saying, I think he has a problem, and blah, 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 blah. And of course, I was oblivious to it all, but jail really woke me up to that. And, you know, I called my father because I didn't know what else to do. And I said, you know, I think I'm in trouble because, you know, if I get out of here, I'm going to go out and continue living the way I was living before. And he was aware that I was living that way because, like a good son, I would call and threaten that I was going to go out and, you know, destroy myself with drugs and alcohol if he didn't send me $500. I was like holding an emotional gun to his head. And, you know, tough love, he's like, I'm sorry, I can't do it. You know, you're on your own. And you know, he was relieved to hear from me that I was in jail because he knew I was in a safe place. But I wanted to go to treatment in San Francisco. He says, well, I think you ought to come to Lynchburg. Your chances of staying sober might be a little bit better. And, deep down, I knew he was right. And so I agreed. Went before the judge, got released, and went to Lynchburg, Virginia. And ended up going to an outpatient program where I was miserable without a drink or a drug for about 40 days, 45 days. I was on this job getting paid half of what I was worth, cooking, you know, and thinking to myself, you know, I could run this place better than the owner, and egomaniac with an inferiority complex and a lot of resentment and with one set of clothes on his back. And I was walking to work and my parents wouldn't even give me a key to the house while I was staying there because they just didn't trust me, you know, and it was about 9 months before I got a key to the house that I was actually living in. But they let me stay in the office downstairs in the futon, and you know, they were glad to see me and it was good to be there, but, I had a lot of, discomfort without a drink or a drug. And I didn't understand why they wanted me to go to these meetings when I was going 3 times a week to this outpatient treatment place. Why do they want me to go to more meetings somewhere else? And I didn't understand the AA thing or any of that. I thought that was just a, you know, checklist thing where you go there, I didn't have a good concept of what AA was. And, you know, God puts people in our lives. And I think, you know, he put Kirk Saunders in my life, who was working right next to me in this kitchen. He was the grill cook and I was the saute cook in this kitchen. And he kept hounding me, asking me why I'd moved back from California. Why did I leave San Francisco? Why did I come back to Lynchburg where they rolled the sidewalks up at 7 o'clock at night? There's nothing to do here. Why are you coming here and not staying out there? It sounds like you had a great life out there. And of course, I didn't want to get honest and say, I'm going to this treatment center, but he got it out of me. And he says, man, let's go out to the loading dock and have a cigarette and talk. And so I did. And he told me his story, and he was 5 years sober. And he told me his story. And I never heard a man talk like that before, because in treatment, I was told about triggers and euphoric recalls and, you know, and it wasn't like you know, it was a counselor, and then there was a bunch of us who were just dying to go out and have another drink or a drug. And so I was around a bunch of people that were uncomfortably without a drink or a drug. And I never seen anybody comfortable in their own skin talking about their past that I could relate to in a way that I thought, wow, this guy really has had the experience that I had, which alienated me, really. I mean, I didn't think anybody, you know, I couldn't talk to anybody about what I'd been through and what I was doing, because, I mean, they'd look at me like I was, you know, like you got some problems, you know? But he won my confidence in a matter of minutes, just like it talks about in the book. And he convinced me to let him pick me up, to take me to my first meeting. And he took me to my first noon meeting. And I sat there and tears welled up in my eyes, because I heard a whole room full of people sharing my story in bits and pieces. And I never had that experience before. And they were talking about the joys of living sober. And I just was floored. I thought, there's no way these people are real. And, but I was fascinated and awestruck, and, you know, it hit me really hard. And that became my home group for a while. And I ended up finding, he introduced me to a couple of guys, and one of them became my sponsor. And I ended up finally, after, you know, doing a few experiments, stopping and picking up a white chip and going through the steps. And that's what led me to my first 7.5 years sober. And it gives me about 10 minutes to go through the rest of my sobriety, or 15 minutes maybe. But so that was a very strong experience. I got to go through my fourth fifth step with this man, Larry, who sponsored me at the time. And I had a girlfriend, and we got involved like any good alcoholic, you know. I think, you know, it's like the joke of what do you bring on the first date, you know, when you get two AAs together, a U-Haul, you know. And well, I had this place, and, you know, and well, before you know it, it was 3 days later, she moved into that place with me. And because she was living with her sponsor, which, you know, she didn't, you know, it was temporary, quote unquote, and what we had was going to be permanent, quote unquote. And that's where that's how my daughter, you know, who is, lives here in Richmond with me, that's how she was born. And, we had a great relationship for several years. Of course, then I got, selfishly, we ended up separating, and I ended up taking a job in Richmond, and that's what led me here. And it was when I got to Richmond, it was kind of like the new kid in town in AA, and I found a new sponsor, and we did start going through the steps, and I was right at my ninth step. And that's when I started to drift, and, not on purpose. I had a great job, and I was married. You know, had a pretty decent life on the outside. And that's what happens when we get sober and we take some actions. In that first time, I was sponsoring guys until I left for Richmond. And then I kind of like told my sponsees, you're going to have to probably find somebody local, because I'm going to be too busy, and I'm not going to be, you know, I'm going to be 2 hours away, and, you know, it's probably not a good idea. And anyway, so I was not sponsoring anybody, but I did find a new sponsor. And like I said, we went back through the steps, and I slowly backed away. Because, you know, my accountability, you know, I was undisciplined, and I just sort of figured, well, now that I've got this job and I'm married, I need to just focus on my life. And, you know, I don't have as much time to do all that AA stuff. Big mistake. You know, it was a slow drift away from what we do. And my spirit really paid a price. I wasn't praying. I wasn't, you know, I didn't have this prayer and meditation and seeking out a power greater than myself. I didn't feel useful, you know, other than, you know, just, you know, thinking about what I wanted, when I wanted it, and how much I wanted of it. And so I was consumed with self, you know, it's the steps in reverse. And, you know, when I finally took a drink, it was kind of devastating, but it wasn't a shocker, because, you know, it came to me so quickly. But yet, you know, I look back, and it's not surprising that it happened, because I had no defense at that time. And what happened to me was, I separated from my wife because, you know, she was the cause of my problems and my discomfort. And my job was too. And I became, you know, sort of isolating, I guess. And I was starting to live dishonestly. And honestly, I didn't want to be accountable on that level. And what happened was, is my neighbor came over with a six pack one day after my wife and I had separated, and she had a joint, and I just didn't even think twice. I said, let me have one of those. And I drank a beer and took a couple of hits of a joint. And right as I was doing that, I thought, man, what did I just do? I was getting ready to celebrate 8 years of sobriety, and three, you know, I was just 3 months shy of celebrating 8 years, and I just tossed it all away. And, you know, my second thought was, well, I'm not going to tell anybody. And I held on to that for 30 or 40 days. And I'll tell you, it was the most uncomfortable, miserable, lonely, disconnected feeling that I'd had in a long time. And I never thought it would have such an impact on me, but I totally, you know, whatever thread of a connection with a higher power and God that I had prior to that moment when I took a drink was gone. And it was like, I was like the guy out in space who got disconnected from his spaceship and was just kind of floating out there. And I didn't have any connection to anyone or anything. And I felt so alone at that point. And I couldn't tell anybody because I was too ashamed. And I'll tell you, that was a tough place to be. And I finally came back into a meeting where I thought I wouldn't see too many people that I knew. And I picked up a white chip and humbled myself. But unfortunately for a guy like me, the pilot light was already lit. You know, the gas was already turned on and the pilot light was lit. So in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know, nothing really bad happened. You know, who's to say that you can't, you know, live a normal life? You know, all these ideas kept spinning around. And at that point, I had lost that connection with my sponsor and I really wasn't active. I was just kind of on the outside, you know, just going to meetings barely. And my brain was going in overload and the obsession continued. Like I said, the pilot light was lit, the obsession continued. And I wasn't talking to anybody about it because I was still ashamed. And next 2 years I spent, you know, and I caved in and I started drinking again and it got worse. And, you know, I ended up losing everything all over again. And thank God, I mean, it took that for me. And I, you know, separating from a drink or and a drug, because of, you know, getting pulled over by the police, driving intoxicated one night, and I got a charge and possession and yada, yada, yada. And I couldn't pass, you know, drug court where they give you urinalysis tests where you call in your color and you have to go in at random to, you know, give a urinalysis and a breathalyzer. And I couldn't pass those. And I got, you know, whatever they 30 or 40 or 60 days mandatory. And I did that. And talking to my future ex-wife through the glass window, telling her I'm going to go back to those meetings. Life was never so good as when I was in AA and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I got out and, you know, I got out at 11 o'clock one morning and I was waiting for her to pick me up and she was late picking me up and I was resentful. And I told her to stop off at the convenience store and I picked up a 12 pack as soon as I got out of jail. I went right back to it. For the next 4 or 5 months, I drank and miserable and, you know, it just was the place that, you know, that Bill talks about in the big book. You know, it's a loneliness. And I started drinking alone regularly. You know, I drank whenever I could. I drank around the clock. I was a daily maintenance drinker and I would black out or pass out. And that's how I stopped drinking. I would just black out or pass out. And what happened was, is I got a job with some folks that were sober and like God sent the angels in again. And I ended up getting introduced to my previous home group, Jaywalkers. And what happened was, these two guys took me to my first meeting and I was too ashamed to go, you know, but they took me and on my own, I should say, I was too ashamed to go, but they took me. And that's how I got introduced to a home group that got me active. And thank God for that, because if it wasn't for an active home group that was engaged in the solution, talking about sponsorship, God, service work, working with others, you know, the steps, inventory, you know, all these things that really, you know, I needed to stay focused on. And they got me busy. I got a job in that home group and it was my home group for the next 12 years. And I got the sponsor that I have today. He's been the same sponsor for the last 14 years. And And, you know, I tell you, you know, things really changed when I went through the steps and did a four-step honest inventory and answered those questions in the fourth column. You know, where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I resentful? Where was I self-seeking? Where was I afraid? For every resentment, I answered those questions. My sponsor and I went over that in the fifth step, and I had a whole new outlook at that point. And you know, I was definitely well acquainted with my defects, but they didn't go away after I asked God to remove them. Surprisingly, you know, I didn't get struck perfect. But what did happen was, is I became highly aware of the things that made me uncomfortable, and when they do come up, like it talks about in the 10th step, I did make all of my amends to everybody that I could possibly find. You know, there were people out there that I couldn't find because they didn't have a name or a face. There was people that I stole from that I didn't know where they, who they were. And, you know, indirect amends is what my sponsor explained to me. And he's like, you've been a taker most of your life, and now it's time to learn how to be a giver. So I give back in other ways when I, you know, can't make that direct amends to people where I had taken, I give back in other areas. And it's been working out well because, you know, it's taken me to a different place. And, you know, cash register honesty and all that good stuff happens. And what happened to me was, you know, I started to sponsor other guys. And that was probably the most powerful thing for me, because going through the steps one time for me isn't enough. I can't do one of anything. I need to do a lot of steps, you know, many times, because for me, that repetitive nature of, you know, saying prayers every day and revisiting, you know, the process that we go through, especially steps 10, 11, and 12 that we continue on for a lifetime. It says that in the 10th step, this is a process that should continue for a lifetime. We continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And when these things crop up, we ask God to remove them at once and discuss them with someone immediately. And if we owe any money amends, we make it, you know, to promptly admit when I'm wrong and all that stuff, and being humbled and, you know, having that level of humility and being able to be honest with myself and other people has changed the dynamics of all of my relationships. It has improved all the relationships that I have when I practice it. You know, when I don't practice it, those relationships tend to begin to suffer. But when I do practice it, it's like watering a plant. It starts to come back to life, and I start to feel the connection, and I can see the beauty of, you know, what's going on, and God's presence is kind of right there, you know, and it's like I can feel it, but it's not always there. You know, there's times when I feel like, okay, why do I feel like, you know, it's my day of bad luck or whatever, but those days don't really happen as days. They happen as little moments where I start to see myself experiencing a little bit of doubt or a little bit of fear or a little bit of selfishness that creeps up and think, why me? Well, you know, everybody gets a flat tire every once in a while. Everybody gets, you know, life on life's terms here and there. And it's just, you know, another opportunity to gain some experience that hopefully will not just, you know, I'll survive it, but maybe it'll benefit somebody else. And that's been what my experience has been like with my drinking and everything that led me up to Alcoholics Anonymous is what I used to share to help other people. Because when I'm talking to somebody new, I'm not going to talk to them about, you know, what it's like to you know, go on vacations or go out and do all these wonderful things that I just couldn't even fathom doing when I was newly sober. But, you know, what happens when I go to bed with some money in my pocket and I wake up with that same amount of money in my pocket and I pay the people that I owe money to and I maintain my responsibilities, magical things happen and your credit gets restored and God gives you more responsibility because we become more disciplined. And for me, it's all based on my ability and willingness to follow simple suggestions. And I try to remain teachable today. So whenever asked to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, I always say yes. And I think that's all I got tonight. I'm going to pass. Thanks. It's great to see you guys.